Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Eric Larson, who is the author of Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Eric Larson is also the author of 7 books in all, including In the Garden of Beasts, Thunderstruck, Devil in the White City, and a couple of early books, Naked Consumer, Lethal Passage, Isaac Storm. You said in an interview that it was looking at a book on a whim that you discovered, The Lusitania.
The thing about Lusitania is that it had always kind of been on my mind to do, but I had always been reluctant because it seemed like it was too obvious, too familiar. I tend to like ideas that have what I refer to as barriers to entry. That is to say, they're complex enough that I'm pretty guaranteed that nobody else is going to do it, right? But, you know, I have this maritime thing, and I was interested. I mean, frankly, I would have done something on the Titanic if not for the fact that, you know, it's been done to death by, you know, James Cameron and so forth. So one day when I was, you know, back in what a friend of mine refers to as that dark country of no ideas, I just started reading about the Lusitania because why not? And immediately I realized a couple of things. One was that I didn't really know anything really about the actual elements of the disaster, the human thing. I just knew it as a, you know, from a high school class, you know, some geopolitical node on a timeline leading to World War I. And then as soon as I started reading, though, about the details of the sinking, I thought, wow, this is really very compelling. You know, one in particular leapt out at me from the beginning, which was that during the sinking, one fully loaded lifeboat, while being launched, fell on top of another. You know, and that was like, whoa, they don't teach you that in high school. So that was very compelling.
It seemed to me that because of the disaster of the Titanic, which was only 3 years earlier, that somehow the Lusitania got lost in some kind of historical shuffle. And other than the fact that it was sunk, we kind of put it at second-rate disaster.
Well, it's true. It's true. And I think in part it is because of the Titanic. The Titanic disaster had so much, well, I hate to call it romance, but that I guess that's as good a term as any. It had so much romance associated with it. And also it was a much different sort of a sinking. I mean, this thing went down in 3 hours, and there was the lack of lifeboats and the fact that it was, you know, the maiden voyage and all that. But yes, I think it did eclipse the Lusitania. And actually another disaster, the worst maritime disaster, which occurred in between the two of them, the sinking of the Empress of Ireland in the St. Lawrence River after a collision with a coal ship, which nobody knows about, you know. Another part of why it's receded somewhat, though, I do believe has to do with the fact that it's viewed more through the lens of World War I than as a distinct maritime disaster. And I think that's actually a mistake, and that's kind of what I'm trying to correct in this book. Because, you know, one of the things that we, certainly I, had in my perception before starting to look into the Lusitania was that it was essentially the World War I equivalent of Pearl Harbor. You know, ship gets torpedoed, next day we're in the war, right? And in fact, during the research, I would ask those few actually who knew that I was actually working on I keep things pretty close to myself, but my family knew and a few others. And I would ask them, I'd say, so how long do you think it took between the time the Lusitania got torpedoed and we got into the war? And the answers range from 2 days to 2 months, when it was in fact 2 full years. And then, you know, when Wilson finally asked for a declaration of war or approval that America go to war, he never once mentioned the Lusitania. Too many other things had happened in between.
The Zimmerman telegram was the key, not the Lusitania.
Well, the Zimmerman telegram was the final straw, but even leading up to the Zimmerman telegram, and the Zimmerman telegram, again, was an intercepted message intercepted by the British. The German Foreign Office was offering Mexico a deal where if they helped out with a treaty between the two of them, that if all things went well, then Germany would help Mexico acquire American territory that used to be Mexican, you know, Texas and New Mexico, which was a big deal. But there had been other things as well. There had been sinking of American flag ships, which was very important to know. Lusitania had been a British ship with Americans aboard, but suddenly the Germans had begun sinking actual American flagships. That was also very provocative.
There's a lot of elements here that we don't know about today, and I'm going to tackle the big one first, which is the clear connection, at least in my mind, between Winston Churchill and the Lusitania and the Bush administration and 9/11.
Oh, boy. Well, let me deal with Churchill and the Lusitania. So the lingering question, the lingering question with the Lusitania is, you know, why was this ship carrying valuable munitions? And that was no secret, by the way. It was carrying munitions. Why was this ship fully loaded, 2,000 people aboard, a record number of families, children, infants? Why was the ship allowed to be in those waters around the UK with a known submarine threat? Why did this happen? And the question is, well, was this Churchill's nefarious plot to try to get America into the war early? And you know, there's no smoking memo. There's no bit of correspondence that says, let's set up the Lusitania. There is one tantalizing thing that early in the war, Churchill writes to the board of head of the Board of Trade in Britain. He says that, you know, we, meaning Britain, we need all the traffic from America that we can possibly get because of supplies. And he says, and if some of it gets into trouble, all the better. So clearly, Churchill would not have minded if something had happened to drag America into the war early. Whether he had anything to do with this is not at all clear. The way I look at it is there's a lot of evidence that makes you really seriously consider that maybe the Lusitania was, in fact, set up, put in harm's way. However, if you look at that evidence really hard and you try to say without a shadow of a doubt, if you gave it to a jury, was there a plot to sink the Lusitania on the part of the Admiralty? The answer is no. There's not enough there. If you turn it around and try to prove that there was no plot, you can't do that either. So I lay it on one British, prominent British naval historian, a historian actually of naval intelligence, former naval intelligence officer, who early on, when he wrote about Room 40 and considered the Lusitania thing in passing, said that it was the result of, as he put it, a monumental cock-up mistake. Later in life, he changed his mind because of additional evidence that came forth. And he decided that that in fact there had to have been a plot because nothing else explained what happened that day. Why on earth was this valuable ship with 2,000 people aboard and munitions, badly needed munitions, why was it allowed to be in those waters when there was a known submarine threat?
And the corollary of that is that afterward, the Admiralty tried to hang it on the captain.
Which makes absolutely no sense. You know, the publicity value of hanging the sinking, this absolutely clear atrocity, you know, of the 2,000 people aboard, 1,200 were civilians, you know. I mean, this was an absolutely clear atrocity. The publicity value in just simply laying it on the Germans was so huge. And yet, the Admiralty chose to attempt to blame Captain Turner, the captain of the Lusitania. It didn't work. The inquiry that resulted did not go the way the Admiralty wanted it to. The head of the inquiry, Lord Mersey, would not buy it. But just the fact that they tried is incredible.
Eric Larson, the entire story of the Lusitania is really the story about the origins of World War One, and World War One is kind of forgotten.
The way World War One is perceived in Britain is obviously very different than it's perceived in America. And it's still, in fact, I've talked to a number of Britons who are transplanted to America since this book came out. And there is still a sense that I pick up of lingering national resentment that America came into the war so late. It's really kind of fascinating.
They came into the war at a time, as you say, when, in fact, Britain was losing, though. In trying to understand winning and losing in the Great War, which is what it was known as, is itself very difficult.
It is very difficult. What was happening by the time America did enter World War One, you know, the land forces had been essentially a stalemate, a brutal stalemate, a bloody stalemate. I mean, unbelievable casualties on both sides, but it was a stalemate. However, within the German government, there had been a disagreement since 1914. Over how the submarine war should be executed. Civilian leadership in Germany felt that it was very dangerous to leave, you know, the decision as to whether we end up in a war with America in the hands of a submarine commander, you know. The German naval leaders wanted to take all the gloves off and have absolutely unrestricted submarine warfare on the argument that they could bring Britain to heel before America could even land a single soldier on the continent. the German naval officers ultimately prevailed, launched this unrestricted campaign, and in fact, it came close to working. It came close to working. They were destroying ships at an incredible rate, so much so that it was said that any ship that left Britain had a 25% chance of being sunk at some point.
And there were no depth charges. Was there a submarine fleet of Britain's?
Britain had a submarine fleet, and in fact, Britain had more submarines, in fact, than Germany, but used them differently, did not use them for surprise attacks against merchant shipping, hoped to use them against military targets. Germany had far fewer, but used them in a very different way.
There's constant talk, particularly when the Lusitania is going across, which is May 1915. Now, essentially, this is an ocean liner traveling from New York to Liverpool with passengers at a time when submarines are knocking off whoever they could get at that point.
Right.
Which, of course, again, brings up the question of why didn't it even sail, let alone why didn't it have an escort when it reached dangerous waters. But the line from Britain seems to be, well, they wouldn't do that because people at war don't do that. And yet, at the same time, they'd already seen the poison gas that the Germans were destroying people with.
It was at a very odd intersection of the rules of so-called civilized warfare were changing, very fluid at this point, and the Lusitania sailed really in the midst of one of the most significant changes of all. And that is that for the prior 100 years, a set of rules referred to as the prize law or the cruiser rules had governed naval action that involved civilian warships. These rules, first of all, prohibited any attack on a passenger ship and required that any attack on a merchant ship, on a civilian cargo ship, the crew would have to be kept safe. I mean, you could, under certain circumstances, sink the ship, but the crew first had to be kept safe. And in most cases, the idea was to put a so-called prize crew on the ship and bring it into a port safely, and there have a so-called prize court determine its fate. Well, the submarine, and nobody understood this really at the time, even the navies of Germany and Britain did not understand the submarine. It was so new, it was such a novel force. The submarine just totally changed all the rules, because for one thing, it was too small, had too few crew to put a prize crew aboard a target ship. Also, its strength, and, you know, frankly, this is a lesson we all need to learn today, a weapon will be used to its maximum effect in a war. And what the submarine allowed was essentially a degree of invisibility and attack without warning. The initial belief was that Germany would never use that power against civilian shipping. A few people in the British hierarchy believed that it would, one of them being Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote a very prescient short story before the war. But nobody believed that they would actually dare to do it, including Churchill. But lo and behold, they did dare.
Eric Larson, let's get into your research. You made the decision that you would broaden it to include the story of Woodrow Wilson, the story of U-boats themselves, and, of course, background to World War I itself in Europe. Did you have other narratives that you were thinking of adding but had to kind of put aside because you realized that it was getting too big?
There are always additional narratives that I try to work into a book. Frankly, my feeling is that I'm not happy unless, by the time I'm done with the first draft, unless I have, you know, 2 or 3 times as much material as I need, because it's really only by cutting that you get to the good stuff. There were other narratives. There were other characters. There were scenes and so forth that I cut out that I just felt were sort of extraneous. See, one of my goals with this, the thing that I felt that I could bring new to the historiography of the Lusitania, you know, it wasn't necessarily that I was going to break new news. You know, I mean, there are some new things in there, but the thing I bring to the party is the telling. And what I realized early on from my exploration of various archives was that the Lusitania episode offered me something that I had never been able to do with any of my books before, because the reservoir of material, of primary archival material, was so rich and so deep. And so what it offered me, was an opportunity to tell this story with maximum suspense, to really sort of put on my Alfred Hitchcock hat and just really let it go and tell it as a maritime thriller. That was my goal.
Well, you also looked for the most interesting characters, so you focus in on a bookseller named Charles Laureate, who's bringing Thackeray drawings and Dickens on board, and a very strange woman named Theodate or Theodata, who is kind of an occultist.
That's right, Theodate Pope. She was a spiritist, but she was also one of America's first licensed female architects. She was also among that cadre of women who were first to embrace the term feminist, which was relatively newly coined. But what I really liked about her, I mean, I liked also the fact that her backstory, she was wrestling with depression, which is something many people, of course, recognize and deal with today. And it's nice to know that, you know, our troubles today, the people back then had some similar issues. Anybody who's in this book is in there for a reason, a very specific, practical reason, and that is that they left behind a lot of detail. And that is what is absolutely necessary if you're going to do this kind of history, which is referred to often as narrative nonfiction. I don't particularly like that label. But if you're going to tell a story like this, a nonfiction story, true story, and you're going to tell it in a way that reads like a novel, you got to have the material. You can't fake it. And the material is there in spades.
You're listening to an interview with Eric Larson, whose book is titled Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. I'm Richard Belinsky on Bookwaves. You said in an interview that the greatest surprise was being granted a look at morgue photos, which brought it home. But apart from that particular surprise, what surprise in history did you run across that just made you go, whoa?
First of all, my misconception that the Lusitania was the thing that got us into World War I. Some of the details of the sinking, of course, were amazing and deeply tragic. But I think what really surprised me was the nature of submarine life. I mean, the World War I German U-boat was, first of all, not terribly good at being underwater in the first place. It couldn't stay under for very long. It could not go very fast underneath. And this is partly why people really did feel that the Lusitania was too big and too fast to be ever caught by a submarine. If a submarine were underwater, its top speed was 9 knots. Lusitania was capable of 25 or 26 knots if traveling at absolutely full speed. So the nature of the submarine, its inherent fragility, the flawed character of torpedoes. The Germans did a calculation. They found that 60% of torpedo firings failed for one reason or another. 60%. You know, it just totally goes against what you would imagine. So a lot of that kind of thing frankly, everything surprised me.
And what about a disappointment, something that you were looking for and just couldn't find?
Yeah, well, there's always many disappointments, you know, things you hope to find and when you go in and that you don't. Now, happily, you generally end up finding a lot more that you never expected to find, and that's the case with this. But, you know, I would love to have found some kind of a diary or some detailed account by Captain Turner himself. It doesn't exist. I would love to have found some kind of personal memoir by the submarine commander in the wake of the whole thing, but that doesn't exist either. I would also have loved to have found a passenger who somehow had survived and had managed to preserve a really, really, really detailed diary of the whole voyage. I couldn't find that either. But on the other hand, there was so much else, so much other material that just allowed the story and me to construct this narrative. Well, one of the things that was really crucial was this war log of the submarine captain, Captain Schwieger, which detailed his entire patrol from the moment he left Germany to the moment he returned to Germany, including narrative portions, you know, encountering, and which depict this horrible voyage, you know, this horrible patrol was not going the way he wanted it to go. And then suddenly, by sheerest chance, he encounters the Lusitania.
Let's talk for a second about the Lusitania. There's one photo on the title page of the ship leaving the harbor. And if you go online and you give the URL, you can see the ship leaving the harbor. There's a film of it. Inside the ship, the only thing I could think of was I kept thinking about, since this was the same era as the Titanic, I kept thinking that if you saw the movie Titanic, you'd get a pretty good idea of what it was like inside. Were they pretty similar that way?
Similar in terms of the overall aspect. I mean, if you're thinking about first class on Lusitania versus first class on the Titanic, you know, both were very lavish abodes for seagoing travel. I mean, for example, on the Lusitania, if you booked a certain first class cabin, you would have a wood-burning fireplace in your room, which is not so shabby. It was considered that the second class on Lusitania was actually as good as first class on many other ships. And one other thing about the Lusitania was that third class, so-called immigrant class, was actually very good also because Cunard was really trying to win a lot of the immigrant traffic. So overall, the ship was very glamorous, very well appointed. The meals were incredible, especially in first class, but also third class was very good. But first class, the meals were unbelievable, you know, with just a multitude of entrees, so much so that, in fact, at one point, for one voyage, Cunard had to actually publish a separate sheet with a suggested menu that you might choose from all the various entrees. So it was a very glamorous ship.
When the ship went down, I assume that it was scavenged fairly quickly because it was in pretty shallow waters.
Well, 360 feet. I don't know. I'm not a diver. I don't know. I mean, artifacts have been brought up from the ship. I believe at one point it was declared to be an Irish heritage site. It's essentially a grave site.
Did you go over there and take a look?
I did not go over there to take a look at the water. I didn't even go to Ireland. I actually ran out of money before I went to Ireland. There was so much else that I had to do and so much ground I had to cover, but I had been over those waters.
Room 40, which is kind of the equivalent, I guess, of the group that Turing had during World War II, the Bletchley of World War I. Did you know about Room 40, or did you find out about it in your research?
When I started reading about the Lusitania, I knew nothing about Room 40. It was just the contours of the disaster itself. And then I learned about Room 40, and I thought, wow, this is unbelievable. You know, this super secret entity within the Admiralty that took advantage of, you know, the recovering three of Germany's most important code books. Germany completely unaware and sufficiently arrogant that they never tried to change their code books. So for most of the war, Room 40 was able to read just about every wireless, intercepted wireless message between German naval vessels and bases and so forth, which was an incredible achievement. One result of that was that they knew exactly the comings and goings of U-20, the U-boat that sank the Lusitania.
Eric Larson, you also spend some time on the love relationship of Woodrow Wilson, and you brought that in because you wanted to give a broader picture of what was going on at the time.
Yeah, well, actually, I brought that in because once I came across those love letters, there was no way they were not going to be in this book. For me, you know, the fundamental narrative framework of a book is really just an excuse for a man just bringing everything in there, bringing all the ornaments to hang on that tree. And one of the things about this was, the thing is that Wilson, as of August 1914, when World War I began in Europe, he also at that point, with remarkable timing, he lost his wife of many years. He was cast into deepest grief. He was very alone. Come the spring of 1915, he had fallen head over heels, and I mean head over heels, in love with a 40-something Washington widow named Edith Bowling Galt. He fell in love with her. She was not returning the favor, at least not at first. And he wrote to her these dozens of the most passionate love letters, these outpourings of longing and need, which were so opposite to any perception I had of President Wilson. I'd always thought of him as kind of a stiff, you know, kind of prim and proper guy. And so when I came across these letters in the Library of Congress, yeah, I'm just sitting there at my desk reading these letters. It was like, oh my gosh, I never knew these existed. Now, I did not discover these letters. I mean, anybody who's done a biography of Wilson, and there have been many biographies of Wilson, anybody who's done a biography of him has read these letters, knows that they exist. They came brand new to me, and in the context of the Lusitania, they had a very different resonance because, you know, a number of these, quite a few of these really, really passionate letters were written during that very period when the Lusitania was making its way across the ocean. And I love that kind of thing where you can cut from one thing to another. You cut from the Lusitania to the submarine, to Room 40, to Wilson, and you keep doing that back and forth, and, you know, you can build up a pretty good head of suspense.
The only limitation is that, unlike a novelist, you can't put a gun in the handbag because the handbag already exists. So you are stuck.
But that's the whole point. That's why I was drawn to this thing in the first place, was by this vast reservoir of material that pretty much assured that I would never be stuck for anything.
In a metaphorical way, were there guns in the handbag that later got used?
There was, in fact, a passenger who had a gun, and that was interesting. I mean, I did the checkup approach with him. I mentioned his gun early on, and he eventually then tried to use it later, much to his eternal shame. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, one of the other lingering mysteries, or, well, you know, there are a lot of mysteries that supposedly linger about the Lusitania that, frankly, are not mysteries and should not be considered so any longer. One is, there's always the question I'm asked, well, was the ship carrying munitions? And yes, it was carrying munitions. Quite publicly, it was carrying munitions. They were on the manifest that was released by Cunard. You know, really a very large quantity of small arms ammunition and also a significant quantity of sort of quasi-inert shrapnel shells. But these did not have anything to do, by the way, with the actual sinking of the ship.
Well, you mentioned that, and if there was so much on board, did that in any way hinder the war effort? I mean, the sinking that way?
The war was consuming so many rounds of ammunition, so many shells, and so forth. However, the case of the shells is a little bit of an exception there, because Britain had been running low on field artillery shells, which is another element of the story, and that is, if Lusitania were carrying these badly needed shells, it's another question as to why was there no escort if that was the case? Why, if there was all this small arms ammunition, why was there no escort provided? So it all adds up, and it all adds murk to the tale.
And it's either malign neglect or a cock-up of the First Order.
Exactly. Well, or something even worse than malign neglect. We don't know.
Derek Larson, let's go back to your career, because I went online, looked at your website, and, you know, you worked for the Wall Street Journal, you moved on up the journalism route, you decided to write The Naked Consumer, but then you decided to write narrative, historical nonfiction. What brought you to the kind of books that now are called Erik Larson books?
It was an evolutionary thing. I mean, my first book was a book about contemporaries, about how companies spy on individual consumers, and I think it might have been a lot more relevant today, even than then. That was The Naked Consumer. And then I did a book about gun culture and the travels of a single handgun and of the model gun and the forces that put it in the hands of a kid who used it to kill a teacher in Virginia Beach, Virginia. But, you know, with both those books, one thing I realized, first of all, was that books about contemporary subjects have a short shelf life, shorter shelf life. And I'd always had an interest in history, and I'd sort of begun looking into some historical subjects when, quite by accident, I stumbled across this gigantic hurricane that destroyed the city of Galveston in the year 1900. I started looking into that and thinking about doing a book about it, started looking for characters through whom to tell it, came across Isaac Kline. And if there's a theme in my so-called narrative nonfiction works, it is that when there is hubris, there are good stories and often tragedy. And in this case, this is a guy, the chief weatherman in Texas, Isaac Kline, who believed really that he knew all there was to know about weather, but did not, and got it fatally wrong. I think that's what I argue in this book. So I began trying to figure out how to tell that story. And actually, I credit a lot with my agent, who really forced me to think through how I was going to tell this story. You know, you do a book proposal when you do nonfiction work, and he kept returning that thing to me to the point where I was about ready to dump him, and he knew it. And he knew it, and finally said, okay, we're ready. And by then, you know, I had figured out the contours of this narrative and how it was going to work, provided everything was out there in the archives. And luckily it was, and more. But that's what started me on the process. And I realized, I love this. I love this because, you know, fiction, you got to make everything up, right? That's hard. It's hard. And I would argue that nonfiction, doing narrative nonfiction, is a lot easier. I mean, you can't take shortcuts. You've got to have the material. And unfortunately, there are some writers who feel you can take shortcuts by, like, creating composite characters or making up dialogue or imagining encounters and so forth. But you can't do that. At least I can't do that. But what I have found is that this kind of writing works for me on so many levels. The research, I love. It's like a detective story every day. And then when I'm, you know, starting to tire of the research and I feel I've got critical mass, then I get to write. And I love that too.
Erik Larson, there are times where, you know, you say, well, we don't know exactly what the final meal was, but here are some menus that it could have been. So you're able to work around that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good example. It's like, okay, we don't know. There may, in fact, be some reference somewhere to what the meals were on that last day and the last voyage. So I don't say, well, it could have been this. I say, on one voyage, it was this. You know, as a way of saying, this is the kind of thing, and you know, which is, I think, perfectly reasonable. I'm not never trying to say, so it may have been on this voyage that they were serving duck à l'orange. I don't say that at all. I say, on one past voyage, it was duck à l'orange. So
there's one guy, very handsome man, who appears throughout the book, who everything is secondhand, but he made such an impression that he became his own character.
Right. Yeah. You're talking about Richard Preston Pritchard, known as Preston Pritchard, not Richard Pritchard, because it was too weird. But Preston Pritchard was a very interesting character, and I don't necessarily want to explain how we know what we know about him. But he became, for me, a very interesting exercise in narrative because of how we know the things we know about him. And maybe that's even giving something away. But I really enjoyed trying to figure out how to work that young man into the story.
Well, the two main characters are Schwieger, and Turner. And for them, you have a tremendous amount of material because you managed to get hold of Schwieger's log. Where was that?
Yeah, Schwieger's war log, well, the original is in the archives, the National Archives of the UK. I got a translation that actually is from a more local archive, the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. It's the same log, I mean, it just happens to be a translation of it. The log was really a crucial find. If the log had not existed, I'm not sure I could have done the book.
At what point did you find it?
Relatively early. And it's the thing that allowed me to structure the narrative in a way that would be a very suspenseful narrative. Because when you think about it, if you have this war log and it tells you everything about this voyage from the moment he left Germany to the moment he got back, including narrative passages, passages about weather, precise position reports. And by the way, interesting little detail about Google Maps is that you can plug in the longitude and latitude coordinates and you will find out right on Google Maps where the submarine was. It's really delightful. But so what this war log did was allow me to tell the story in a suspenseful way. Because if you know where the submarine is and you know what's happening aboard and you know where Lusitania is and you know what's happening aboard, you know that they're going to encounter each other at some point. You have that converging story and that's nothing but sheer suspense.
So when you had the Lusitania story, you had a single story, but once you had that, you knew you could cross-cut between those two, go off to the Admiralty, go off to America, and then you've got all of the various elements in the pot.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And then work in all the sort of bizarre, freakish elements that kind of also play into the story. I mean, for example, the fact that the day before sailing the Lusitania, before the ship sailed, Captain Turner was summoned to give testimony in a case involving the Titanic. He was, asked all these questions that had to do with the compartments on ships and on his ship and his attitudes about, how safe large vessels were, and also his testimony about the Titanic, which is fascinating. Fascinating. The day before he leaves, he's talking about the previous, best known wreck. So, elements like that, and so even the little things that I love. For example, the fact that May 1st, the departure day, was known as Straw Hat Day. Which was the day that men in America and the East Coast in particular were allowed to shed their winter hats and start wearing their straw hats of summer, which was a rule that men obeyed. It was a sartorial requirement. So I loved all those little details.
When you're working on historical books like this or in the Garden of Beasts, obviously the thought of what's going on in current life has to come through when you try to find, if not parallels, at least metaphors. Did you find any here?
The first thing I would say is that this is strictly a story about the Lusitania, and I'm not sure that there is much resonance to today, except for the fact that, if you think hard about it, you think that really one aspect of the story of the Lusitania is about this brand new weapon, the submarine, right? And the lesson there is that, when there is a weapon and it has certain capabilities, I believe the lesson is that it will be used to the maximum of those capabilities, no matter what the end result. And I think then that you could look around today and, take drones. Drones, we don't understand drones. And drones we're going to understand them in a bad way, I think, at some point within the next 2 to 5 years. But even more than that, something that we do understand, but that I think we have all tended to now disregard as being a past problem, which I don't believe is a past problem at all, and that is nuclear weapons. You know, I think we have a kind of a, almost an overconfidence, a hubris today that nobody would ever dare use one of those things, you know, today. I don't think that's true. I don't trust Putin not to use it. I don't trust India and Pakistan not to use it. And above all, not the terrorists of the world. And in fact, if I were president, I would make the control and suppression of nuclear weapons the single policy of my administration.
Eric Larson, now you've finished Dead Wake. Are you still searching around, or have you found the next topic?
I am still flailing. I'm looking for my next subject. I don't know what it is going to be. I'm looking into something that is interesting to me, has more of a Devil in the White City quality, not about a World's Fair, but has sort of that same kind of quality to it, the kind of song of the planes running through it. But I haven't decided on anything yet.
And you won't know until you find the Schweiger's log.
And I won't know until I find the equivalent of Schweiger's log, yeah. I mean, there has to be something, when I'm thinking about ideas, there has to be something that just suddenly says, oh, wow, I get this. Now I understand this story. Now I understand how I'm going to tell this story. And actually, in the case, for example, of Devil in the White City, it was a single fact. It was a single fact that was in the footnote of an otherwise really tedious history of the World's Fair of 1893. And that was the fact that juicy fruit gum was introduced to consumers for the first time in 1893. And I don't know why that just lit my imagination, but it did, because, you know, I love juicy fruit gum, and here it is. I'm thinking, that's 100 years old. So anything can be the trigger. I'm just looking for it. I'm hoping, leaving myself open.
What I found interesting about the Lusitania is it occurred to me, and I'm sure it occurred to you in writing it, that despite the fame of the sinking of this ship, despite the fact that, you know, if you look at old copies of the New York Times, the sinking is right there. There's never really been a popular book about it or movie.
Well, there have been attempts. I mean, there have been books about the Lusitania. There was not a terribly good movie done about the Lusitania, kind of a TV-ish thing. But it hasn't been done in the way that, for example, James Cameron did Titanic. And frankly, because of the way he did Titanic, probably no movie will ever be done about the Lusitania. Yeah, he broke the bank, broke the box. And in terms of a popular book about Lusitania, you know, again, there have been books that were done, but maybe it just takes a certain time for a certain book to appear that makes people read about it. The Titanic was really not brought to national consciousness until Walter Lord wrote Night to Remember. And that was, I believe, in the 50s. And then from then on, it's like, wow.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Larson, whose book is titled Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves. This interview was recorded at Dominican University in Marin County, California, with the special assistance of Book Passage Bookstore, Corte Madera, California. For more information about this program, go to bookwaves.com, where you'll also hear an extended version of this interview.